The following Dharma talk was recorded in July 2014 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of three recordings from the retreat called Cultivating Insight with an Open Heart, taught by Phil Jones. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Philip Jones has practiced meditation since 1987 and has been teaching insight meditation since 1996. He has studied with teachers from Spirit Rock and the Insight Meditation Society and graduated from the first Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. More info can be found at www.silentmindopenheart.org.
So earlier this year, I was fixing dinner one Saturday evening and sort of listening to a program on public radio, to the best of our knowledge. And there was an interview with a man, Joss Ruxin, the author of A Thousand Hills to Heaven, Love, Hope, and a Restaurant in Rwanda. Ruxin and his wife had originally moved to Rwanda some years after the genocide to work as aid workers. And then they decided to stay and opened this restaurant that they called Heaven. And then he wrote a book about it. So at one point in the interview, the interviewer asked him about a story from the book. And he described that he and his wife had moved into a new house that they could rent for a while. And shortly after they moved in, a group of women came and knocked on the door. And they explained that one of the women believed that her brother, who was killed in the genocide, had been buried in the backyard of this house. And so they asked if it would be okay if they could come and recover the bones at some point. And Ruxin agreed to this, and he said that it really wasn't shocking that that there were bones buried in his backyard, because in this area of the city, whenever it rained, bones would show up. They would be revealed. What he found shocking was that all of these women, as they were digging in the ground and recovering the bones of this loved one, were quite joyous, quite happy. And so then at this point in the interview, that really has prompted me to tell this story, and really is what prompted this talk. The interviewer said, "I just find that astonishing. How do people arrive at that level of forgiveness, and how are they able to move past the anger?" Ruxin replied, "Living in Rwanda after all these years, it's something that we still don't understand. We have friends who miraculously have absolutely forgiven those who killed their family members. And the way they describe it to us, and it's a very similar experience across our friends, is that the hatred weighed so heavily on their hearts that they felt freed when they were able to meet the killers of their parents or their siblings and forgive them." The hatred weighed so heavily on their hearts that they felt freed when they were able to meet the killers and forgive them. This is one of the challenges in living this human life. It's not just a challenge for people who experience the unfathomable horror of something like something that happened in Rwanda or Bosnia or the genocides in Cambodia and Germany, or even more recently, the plane that was shot down over Ukraine. It's a challenge for people who individually have experienced the violation and loss of any kind of crime. Murder, rape, incest, muggings, burglary, you name it, whatever kind. It's a challenge for people who have been treated in any kind of mean or cruel way. In other words, it's really a challenge for all of us. How do we forgive when someone has hurt us in some way? What came up for me when I heard the interviewer's question was that we forgive when we can see for ourselves the damage that we're doing to ourselves by clinging to our hate, by clinging to our sense of injury, to our sense of having been victimized. One of the key things that allows us to forgive is being brave enough and desperate enough to look into the heart of our own suffering, to see for ourselves that by holding on to it, we're hurting, agitating, and tormenting ourselves. This is one of the benefits that we get from our practice. We train ourselves to look, to open, to what is happening in the present moment. And when it's difficult, our practice is still to look, to the extent that we're capable of at any particular time. This is the practice that the Buddha told us to do with the First Noble Truth. He said, "This noble truth of suffering, of dukkha, is to be fully understood." When we do look in this way, with compassion for ourselves, but also with bravery and a deep love for what is true in our lives, we learn that when we resist the truth of our pain, we suffer more. We learn that when we cling to our anger, whether out of a sense of justice or in hopes of avoiding the pain, we're actually tormenting ourselves. As Josh Ruxin's friends realized, the hatred weighed so heavily on their hearts that they felt freed when they met the killers and forgave them. Being willing to look in this way carries us a long way towards forgiveness and release. It doesn't mean that we stop feeling the pain of loss. It doesn't mean that we forget what was done. Most assuredly, it doesn't. Forgiving may actually free us from our hatred enough that we can act more effectively to achieve justice. But as Sharon Salzberg has so eloquently put it in her classic book, Loving Kindness, when we're held prisoner by our own past actions or the actions of others, our present life cannot be fully lived. The resentment, the partially experienced pain, the unwelcome inheritance we carry from the past, all function to close our hearts and thereby narrow our worlds. There's a formal practice of forgiveness that supports us in this process of opening, seeing, and releasing. And I want to emphasize that it is a process. It takes us weeks, months, years, maybe even lifetimes, sometimes to fully forgive. But each step along the way opens us back up to our lives a little bit as they are now, in all of their humanity. As one does the forgiveness practice, mindfulness and compassion are key components. What's important is that we meet whatever arises in our minds and in our hearts with mindfulness rather than with judgment. So one begins the forgiveness recollection with one's own actions. Even if the major issue is pain caused by another. Beginning with ourselves reminds us that we too may have hurt other people. The traditional phrase that we begin with is, if I have hurt or harmed anyone, knowingly or unknowingly, I ask their forgiveness. And then whenever a person or an incident comes to mind, with mindfulness, we experience whatever emotions there are associated with that. Maybe guilt or shame. And then we let it go. And then we express the wish, I ask your forgiveness. After some time with this first part of the practice, when we're ready, we turn to the next part of the recollection. If anyone has hurt or harmed me, knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive them. And then again, we just kind of wait and see what person or what incident comes to mind, meeting that memory with mindfulness, letting it go, and expressing the intention, I forgive you. So this isn't about feeling any particular kind of a feeling. It's about strengthening the intention to forgive this person, this particular person, and the intention to free our hearts from our own anger, our own rage. Sometimes it's enough for us to look, to open, to fully experience for ourselves the truth of the pain we've experienced, to do that internally. But sometimes, as part of fully understanding our suffering, there's also a need to speak our truth, to have it heard by others. And this can be tricky, because speaking our truth can also get us more entangled in the story, in the emotions, in the rage, the sense of injury, once again. So we really have to work at that. We really have to work at seeing if we can speak with mindfulness and from a place of some equanimity. But sometimes it is a necessary step, and so we need to just do it as cleanly as we can, and without the hope that the person who caused the sense of injury, without the hope that they will acknowledge that they have harmed us. Sometimes they may, often they won't. After some time of working with this, we move to the final part of the recollection, forgiving ourselves. The traditional phrase is, "For all of the ways I have hurt or harmed myself, knowingly or unknowingly, I offer forgiveness." This is about being compassionate towards ourselves, about recognizing our own humanity, our own imperfection, and accepting that. It's really easy to get caught in some kind of an ideal of being all-loving and behaving totally perfectly. But all we're really asked to do is to bring awareness and compassion to our own humanity and to that of others, and to recognize that we're all in this together. There's something else that's implicit in this forgiveness process. That's the intention of metta, or goodwill, towards all beings. I have a rather long quote from Shyla Catherine that I'd like to share. Metta, and the happiness associated with it, may arise naturally. It may be cultivated during daily social encounters, or it may be embraced in a formal meditation practice. It is a clear intention that weakens ill will, fear, and blame. It is an attitude of non-contention, a quality that embraces life without conflict. The Pali term metta is derived from a word for friendship, and therefore can be understood as deep friendship with life. This should not imply that metta is necessarily easy. Deep friendship implies being present, connected, and caring even through our difficult times. Metta creates a field of reprieve in which the heart can heal old wounds and the meditator can strengthen restraint, commit to wholesome endeavors, and create resolve for peace, happiness, and insight. It also supports the cultivation of concentration. So when we formally train in goodwill or deep friendship, we're cultivating our intentions. A pleasant feeling of warmth or love or goodwill may arise, but it really doesn't matter whether it does. What's important is that we're planting seeds in our minds and in our hearts that in time and with the right conditions, can bloom into this quality, this beautiful quality of goodwill. I think, as most of you know, similar to forgiveness practice in metta, we use phrases to help cultivate the intention. A traditional form of metta is, depending on the object, we're using to cultivate goodwill. May I, or you, be safe from inner and outer harm. May I, or you, be happy and free from mental distress. May I, or you, be healthy and free from illness and pain. May I, or you, live with ease in the world. And we train in developing goodwill towards a sequence of people. We begin with ourselves, because we deserve goodwill just as much as anyone else. And then we move to a respected person or a benefactor, and then a good friend, and then a neutral person, someone that we don't have a strong positive or negative response to. And then to the person who in the training is referred to as the enemy or the hostile person. Someone in our lives who is difficult. And then we begin to cultivate goodwill towards all beings everywhere. I've heard Sharon Salzberg say that there's really only two parts of this sequence and this recollection that are mandatory each time we do the practice. Sending goodwill to ourselves and to all beings everywhere. Sometimes when we get to the hostile person, the enemy, the difficult person, we may find that it's just not in us at this point to cultivate goodwill towards them. What I found useful in situations like this is to tune back in to the suffering that comes with my own inability to let go of that anger and that sense of hurt. And so, in this situation, sending metta again to myself. May I be happy. May I be free of mental distress. May I live with ease. In time, even though we don't forget what was done, we may then be able to forgive this person, someone who also wants to be happy. In my own experience, I've also found that metta naturally develops and deepens as one engages more and more deeply in doing mindfulness practice and cultivating wisdom. So it's not necessary to do formal metta practice, but it can be helpful. And if that's something you're especially drawn to, you could take it up as your formal meditation practice for some period of time. I'd like to close with this quote from the contemporary Zen Buddhist teacher, James Ishmael Ford. because of the equanimity and wisdom within it. I've lived too long and have seen too much. What I do know, our hearts will be broken. And in that moment, we get to decide what to do with the wound. Resent and hate and fear the next hurt, or not turn away and instead allow the light to shine through the wound. Thank you for your attention.